So, since we have some visitors tonight, those of you that have been in the class, let's help out in answering some questions to kind of get our focus here. If someone asks you what great lesson is found by studying the book of Esther, how would you answer? All right, the providential care of God for His people. And I would certainly agree with that. It shows the providence of God. And yet what is strange about that it talks about the providence of God, what's absent from the book?
God's never mentioned.
God is never mentioned. Isn't that interesting? God is behind the scenes, and yet His name is never mentioned in the book. That's right. And, of course, if you were a Jew, it served a very practical purpose as well, and that is what?
Understand the origin
of one of their feasts that they celebrated, Feast of Purim, P-U-R-I-M. We'll be looking at that in our study tonight. There are a lot of very practical lessons we've been observing as we go through the book, but those two are the focus, really, of what this book is for, the overall value of studying the story of Esther. So we're in chapter 8, bringing us up to this point in our study. In chapter 1, briefly, what happened? Just one sentence. What? That's true.
Oh, okay.
The king had the feast, and what happened? Vashti refuses to come before him, so
she's removed.
That's critical to the whole development of the story. So what happens in chapter 2? Just summary.
The
king seeks a replacement. And of all people to replace a Persian queen who is chosen. A Jewish girl. Why would a Persian king choose a Jewish girl?
He didn't know
she was Jewish. She was pretty. She was a virgin. And she was selected to replace Vashti. Okay, and in chapter 2, we're introduced to another character. So we've seen two characters now. The king, his name was what? Ahasuerus, also known as
Xerxes.
And then we've seen Vashti. Now we've talked about Esther. And in chapter 2, there's another very important character that's introduced. Who is it?
Mordecai.
And what part does Mordecai play relative to Esther? Her cousin, who raised her. That's right. He raised her. She was an orphan girl in a foreign land, but she's raised by Mordecai. She demonstrates faith. She demonstrates morality. She demonstrates humility, which shows that young people can have conviction and morals regardless of where they're at. And so something happens at the end of chapter 2. That's very critical to the rest of the story. You remember what it was? A plot against the king's life was exposed by
Mordecai.
And it was written in the king's chronicles, wasn't it? That's important. Okay. Chapter 3, we're introduced to another fella. Who is he? Haman. A man full of pride. And he became very angry because Mordecai wouldn't bow to him. And instead of wanting to take his anger out simply on Mordecai, he decided to do what? Kill all the Jews. Annihilate the Jews and the Persian under the Persian rule. That's right. And so he persuades the king to do so. And they use this or device that they would cast to determine the date. And so, back in chapter 3, In verse 12, it says, the 13th day of the first month, it was written, but the killing date was on verse 13, the 13th day of the 12th month. So 11 months later, the Jews were to be annihilated. And so we talk about the providence of God. God had made a promise to Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob, whose other name was Israel, and then through Judah, and then through David, that the Messiah would come. What happens if Haman carries out his plot?
There would be no Jewish lineage.
There'd be no Jewish lineage unless God did something else, and Mordecai alluded to that. But this isn't the first time there's been efforts to destroy the royal seed. But nevertheless, that's what Haman wants to do. So, chapter 4, Mordecai persuades Esther to go to the king. She's very hesitant. One of the reasons is the king hasn't called her in 30 days. And you don't just go to the king. If you go to the king without being called and he doesn't receive you, you're dead. But she goes, and she's received. And the king asked what her wish is, and she said, join me for a banquet today. So they did. What you wish, Esther. And by the way, who joined the king and the queen at the banquet?
Haman.
And that's also important in the story. Haman was invited. What an honor to join the king and the queen at this banquet. And so he said, well, what's your request? And she says, I want to have another banquet tomorrow. Come tomorrow. And so they come the second day. And on the second banquet, chapter 7, what happens? What happens in the second banquet?
She tells the king, and then
she tells the king what the Haman has plotted. And, of course, the king said, well, who did this? And she says, Haman did it. And so the king is so angry, he goes out into the garden. What does Haman do while he's out in the garden? Tries to beg her for his life. So here she is. He's falling down at her knees, as it were, on her. King comes back in, and he says, man alive, is he going to force her right here? And so that's the end of Haman. Take him out and hang him on the gallows that he built for Mordecai. And that brings us to our chapter, in chapter 8. Okay. On your lesson sheet, we ask you to note something. It's not that it's critical. It's just something to observe. By the way, we ask about the synopsis of chapter 8, and what we're reading about here is the decree that allowed the Jews to defend themselves. We'll talk about that as we go through the chapter. In chapter 8, verse 1, on that day is a chronological note. So unless I'm missing something, it's on that day of that second banquet. But then when you get to verse 9, so the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, that is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day. And so we had asked you to calculate, and this new decree was written to allow the Jews to defend themselves. And so we ask you, how much time passed between the first decree that you read about in chapter 3 to annihilate the Jews, and this decree allowing the Jews to defend themselves? Did you calculate that?
2 months, 10 days.
2 months, 10 days. And so you wonder, where's the gap? It almost sounds like when you're reading chapter 3, all this just happened right consecutively, but evidently there's some time spans in here for all these events to take place, and it would simply be speculation for us to guess on how all that happened. But it may be that the banquets didn't happen just right upon these events. There may have been some span in there. But nevertheless, just note that it's 2 months and 10 days from the time of the original decree until this decree is written, allowing the Jews to defend themselves. All right, so verse 1, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. Remember, Haman had been exalted right under the king. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. Now, when Esther disclosed what he was to her, no doubt the relationship of cousin, but what would be even more to influence the king toward Mordecai?
He saved his
life. He raised her. Okay, he raised her. He wouldn't have this girl if it wasn't Mordecai. He raised this girl. And then, of course, Mordecai saved his life. But when he says what she is to him, that was something special. So the king took his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, weeping, implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. The king extended the golden scepter to Esther, which of course meant reception. So Esther arose and stood before the king, and she said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight," and we ask you a question on your lesson. What was Esther's first request to the king to avoid the Jews' destruction? And what was it?
To revoke the
decree. That was her first request, and that's what we're fixing to read. So she says, "Let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the calamity which will befall my people, and how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred?" I'm not sure why she would ask that, knowing the laws of the Medes and Persians. Surely she knew the laws of the Medes and Persians. Back in chapter 3, it's stated over the book of Daniel, that when a royal decree went forth in the Medo-Persian kingdom, what was the law? Cannot be revoked. And here she's asking for it to be revoked. And so that can't be done. King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I've given the house of Haman to Esther, and him they've hanged on the gallows because he has stretched out his hands against the Jews. So now you write to the Jews as you see fit in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked." Okay, I can't revoke the other. But what I can do is authorize you to write another decree to enable the Jews some way to deal with this first decree. And then his ring will be on the decree giving it authorization. So back in chapter 3, you may remember in chapter 3, when this first decree was written, they called in the scribes. Verse 12, the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month. And that's what you have here again. And so were they called in again, verse 9, to formulate this decree according to royal law? But be that as it may, they were called at that time on the third month, on the 23rd day. And it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces, which extended from India to Ethiopia. 127 provinces, to every province according to its script, to every people according to their language, as well as to the Jews according to their script and their language. He wrote in the name of Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring and sent letters by couriers on horses riding on steeds sired by the royal stud. In them the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and to defend their lives. This is not the right to murder. This is the right to defend their lives against those who are attempting to murder them. There's a difference. Both are killing. One's murder, one's not. And so, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil. It's a rather comprehensive decree. In fact, if you compare it with chapter 3, in that first decree that was issued, back in chapter 3 and verse 13, They were going to be allowed to kill and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old women and children, and seize their possessions as plunder. Well, this is just the opposite of that. The Jews can attack those who attack them and their armies. They can kill not only the soldiers, they can kill the women and children, and they can take their possessions. It's going to be interesting as we read as to whether or not they did everything the decree allowed. And so in one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the 12th month. So you've got in the 3rd month, verse 9, 12th month. So you've got several months here for the Jews to get ready, get their arms together, make their plans for assembling, for the attack that will be made upon them. A copy of the edict is to be issued as law in each and every province, was published to all the people, so the Jews would be ready for this day to avenge themselves. Not revenge, but to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers, hasted and impelled by the king's command, went out riding on the royal steeds, and the decree went out in the citadel of Susa. We ask you a question. Well, that's in chapter 9, so I'll save it. Okay, and so Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews there was light and gladness and joy and honor in each and every province and in each and every city. Wherever the king's commandment or the decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. It's interesting, as you started this story, where was Mordecai? Where did we find Mordecai as you started this story?
In front of the king's gate,
walking, worrying about Esther, what's going on. Chapter 3, when he found out about the decree, where did you find Mordecai and how was he dressed? He was fasting and mourning and covered in sackcloth and ashes, not even fit garments to come before the king. Now he's wearing royal apparel. He's the second in the kingdom. He's a Jew, not a Persian. And look at the difference from the beginning of this story until now by the providence of God. And there's a statement here at the end of chapter 8 that I think is very interesting. We had alluded to this in a previous class, but here is actually a statement to that effect. Note. And it says, "And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them." If the people of the land became Jews, what fundamental change in their religious thinking had to take place? There's one God. Not polytheism, not idolatry. There's one God, the God of Moses, the God of the Jews. That's a big, big change. How was it affected? God behind the scenes, causing these things to happen. Did God care about the Persians? Yes, he did care about the Persians. Hold your finger here, we'll come right back. Look at Exodus chapter 7. Our Bible, beginning in Genesis chapter 12, actually right at the end of 11, begins to focus in on one special group of people. Who is that man in chapter 12 that becomes the focus of the Bible's record? Abraham. And he was the first man called what?
Hebrew.
So the Hebrews and their descendants. And so you have Abraham and then Isaac and then Jacob and then Joseph. And Jacob had 12 boys. And they're called the children of Israel. Children of Israel. And so then they're taken to Egypt. There they become slaves, and then they're delivered, and then they go to the promised land. The Bible just seems to focus on the children of Israel. Does that mean God doesn't know about Egyptians and Persians and Assyrians? It doesn't at all. Does God love these other people? He does. But he's carrying out this story for the redemption of Assyrians and Persians and Egyptians and Jews and you and me today. And that's what the Bible is dealing with. And that's why it focuses on them. But in Exodus chapter 7, when we read about God sending Moses to Pharaoh and these plagues that are going to take place, in verse 5 of chapter 7, God said that one of the effects of the plagues would be what?
The Egyptians would know that He is God.
The Egyptians would know that I am the Lord. Their gods were ineffective. Their gods were nothing. The plagues were designed not only for Israel's benefit, not only to deliver them, but God cared about the Egyptians. Look at chapter 9 of the book of Exodus. It goes beyond that. Look at verse 16. Do what, Ennis? The whole earth. That's right. Indeed, for this reason, I've allowed you to remain in order to show you my power and in order to proclaim my name throughout all the earth. God could have delivered them with one plague, but He didn't. And there was a purpose in that. It was a gracious purpose. And He wanted all the world to know that Egypt and its gods were nothing, and the God of Moses was the one true God. These things took place over a period, I don't know if it's weeks or months. They were before two nations. Most powerful nation on the earth at that time, the Egyptian nation, then the nation of the Jews. They weren't done in a corner. They were designed for nations to know that the God of this man named Moses is the true and living God. All right, go over to Joshua chapter 2. They leave Egypt. They go on this trek through the wilderness over to another land. They're getting ready to go into what's known as the land of Canaan. There's a city just across the river called Jericho. They're going to attack that city. There's one woman in there who becomes their ally to hide the spies from destruction. You know the story. Rahab. And She wasn't a noble woman, was she? She was a harlot. But she heard the story. Look at verse 8. Before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord has given you the land and that the terror of you has fallen on us and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites, etc. Verse 11, we heard, our hearts melted, no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God of heaven above and on earth beneath. God cared about a harlot in the city of Jericho. And I don't care what kind of life she had lived, God loved her if she'd repent and serve Him. And so it was faith, but it was a faith built on the testimony she had heard. Coupled with that faith is fear. We heard, our hearts melted. We don't want to be under the wrath of this God. And so she hid the spies. Go over to Daniel chapter 5. You remember the story of Nebuchadnezzar, do you not? You remember how Nebuchadnezzar, first of all, he had a dream. His wise men couldn't tell him the dream or its interpretation. Daniel did. But Nebuchadnezzar's heart was lifted up with pride, and God humbled him. Chapter 4 records that. And so then Belteshazzar, the king, his successor, came to power. And he was full of pride, did not acknowledge the God of Nebuchadnezzar. And so you remember the handwriting on the wall. And Daniel was called in. Daniel chapter 5, Daniel makes a very interesting statement to Belteshazzar. Look, he also was driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of beast. Dwelling place was with the wild donkey. Who's the he? Nebuchadnezzar. In other words, Belteshazzar, you knew this. You knew the historical event with Nebuchadnezzar. Until he recognized the Most High God as ruler over the realm of mankind, that he sets it over it whomever he wishes. Yet, You knew it. Yet, you, my son Belteshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. You knew. With blessings, with opportunities come responsibility. You knew, but you didn't do anything about it. You didn't humble yourself before this great God. In chapter 6, when Daniel was thrown to the den of lions by Darius, Darius went to the tomb. And remember, to the den, and he was concerned about Daniel. And in Daniel chapter 6, in verse 26, when Daniel was delivered, Darius said, "I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his kingdom will be forever." So over and over again, and we have a small record of maybe what God was doing in the world. This doesn't mean this is all God was doing in the world. God is concerned about people anywhere, everywhere, regardless of the color of their skin or the language they speak. But he was using the Jews. And here in our study, we find this very interesting statement at the end of chapter 8. "Many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen upon them." They saw what happened to Haman. They saw how Mordecai had been exalted. And when you get to chapter 9, look at verse 3. "Even all the princes of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and those who were doing the king's business assisted the Jews because the dread of Mordecai had fallen upon them." We're told today fear is not a good motive for obedience. I'll tell you what, that's the devil's lie. You better be afraid of this God. His promises are true, his blessings, but also his warnings are true. And so we come to chapter 9, and on your lesson, we ask you about the synopsis of chapter 9. We have two parts to it. What's the first 19 verses? What?
The victories of the Jews.
The Jews defend themselves. They kill their attackers. That's right, verse 19 verses. What's the last part of the chapter, 20 through 32? Feast of Purim's established. So that's what we're looking at as we look at chapter 9. All right, let's look at chapter 9. "Now in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day." Now, you know, we've remarked throughout this book how much more we'd like to know. And one of the marks, I think, of the fact that the Bible is the Word of God is its brevity. It doesn't satisfy human curiosity. Wouldn't you like to know what kind of preparations they made from the third month to the 12th month? What'd they do? Where'd they get their weapons? What plans did they make? Was there anxiety? We don't know. The book's not written just to satisfy curiosity. That's one of the indications of a book that's different than somebody just sitting down and writing something for sale for human curiosity. And so the 12th month comes, the 13th day, when the king's command and edict were about to be executed, on the day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them. I have a question on the lesson. What terms are used in the text to describe those who assaulted the Jews? We've got several verses there. What are they called? Their enemies. Or another term used, they sought their harm. Unfortunately, we live in a society today where preachers get up and preach that Jews are still God's special people and we ought not be their enemies. We ought not be their enemies because they're our neighbors, not because they're Jews. But that's a mistake people make today. But back then, they were God's special people. And God said to Abraham, "I'll make of you a great nation. Those that bless you, I'll bless. Those that curse you, I'm going to curse." And God did exercise a protective hand over this nation, as is evident in their history. And so, The Jews assembled in their cities, verse 2, throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could stand before them, for the dread of them had fallen on all the peoples. Notice how many times that's mentioned. Mentioned right at the end of chapter 8, mentioned here, mentioned again in verse 3. All the princes of the provinces, we read that. Verse 4, indeed, Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai became greater and greater. Thus the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying. Now what's interesting to me, it says they killed their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying. They did as they pleased to those who hated them. In verse 6 it says they killed 500 men. In verse 15 on the next day they killed 300 men. What were they allowed to kill? All, including women and children. If they killed any, it's not stated. It's possible, but it's not stated. Not only were they allowed to kill them, what else were they allowed to do? Plunder them, but they didn't. In other words, this wasn't an act of greed. It wasn't mad revenge. It wasn't that kind of thing. It was a protection. It was a self-defense of their people. And so, in Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. Now, there's 10 names particularly mentioned. Why? We ask you the question about these 10 names on your lesson. What did they have in common? They were Haman's sons. The very man who had issued the decree, got the decree to be written to annihilate the Jews. And so the sons of Haman are put to death. And so, let's say the sons of Haman aren't put to death. What does that open the door for in the next few years?
Same type of thing.
Same type of thing, revenge, hatred. God put up with nations up to a time when their cup of iniquity was full, and he'd send in, for example, Saul to the Amalekites, said, I want you to kill the men, the women, and the children. He said, boy, that's cruel. No. You kill the men and the women, there, you can't recover them. Plenty of time has been given. What about the children? They're not going to grow up with resentment. They're safe anyway. They're okay with God. It's the merciful thing to do. Look what happens right now in our countries where we've been to deliver people, and then what happens later. So anyway, so they kill 500 there and the 10 sons of Haman. And that's reported, verse 11. And so the king says to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in the citadel of Susa. That's in the city. So what then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? In other words, man, if they've done that here, can you imagine how many others they've destroyed? So now what is your petition? It shall be granted to you. What are your further requests? It shall also be done. Esther said, if it pleases the king, let tomorrow also be granted to the Jews who are in Susa to do according to the edict of today, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. So the king commanded it should be done. And verse 15, the Jews in Susa assembled on the 14th day, so there was the 13th day, the original day, and a second day in the city of Susa that the Jews were allowed to kill their enemies, and they killed 300 in Susa. Note, it says in verse 13, they did not lay their hands on the plunder. So it wasn't a greedy thing. Why the additional day? Why the additional 300? We don't know. We know that Esther often went to Mordecai for counsel. It may be that Mordecai knew there was still pockets of enemies, strong resistance that needed to be dealt with, to be removed. And so that second day was allowed. But that's in Susa. But when you get to 16 and the king's provinces, so out in the outlying cities and areas, look, notice how many were killed. 75,000 of those who hated them. That's another description. Those who hated them. But they did not lay hands on the plunder. You notice that said again in 16. It was said in 15. It said again in 16. So neither in the city of Susa nor in the outlying areas did they lay hands on the plunder. And so on the 13th day of the month Adar, this took place in the provinces, in the outlying areas. On the 14th day they rested, but in Susa it's different. They killed their enemies on the 13th and 14th day and rested on the 15th day. And that comes to explain why there were 2 days of celebration for the feast. Therefore, the Jews of the rural areas who live in the rural towns make the 14th day of the month Adar a holiday for rejoicing and feasting and sending portions of food to one another. And then Mordecai records these events and sent letters to the Jews who were in the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to celebrate the 14th day of the month of Adar, the 15th day of the same month annually. So those 2 days became the feast days. And why 2 days? Because of what happened in Susa. And so to fit the situation of not only those in Susa, but those in the rural areas, both days were celebrated annually. Because on these days, the Jews rid themselves of their enemies. And so it was a month that was turned for them from sorrow into gladness, from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and rejoicing and sending portions of food to one another and gifts to the poor. Just a quick note, I was doing some studying on this and I ran across a comment in a well-known commentary. It's called Pulpit Commentary. And this fellow quotes some guy by the name of Hooker. I don't know the guy's name. I guess a commentator of some sort. And what he said, this guy was, and Pulpit agreed with him, that what this event shows is that the church has the right to set up ecclesiastical feast days. Isn't that interesting? You know, it's good to make practical applications from a text, but the text doesn't justify that. Mordecai, at this time, the Jews were not just a religious society, they were a civil society. And Mordecai was in a civil position. And in that civil position, he had the authority to do those kind of things. Doesn't mean today the church, whatever that is, has the right to set up religious holidays like Christmas, for example. And yet people reading these commentaries say, oh yeah, yeah, the church has the right to do that. That's what happened. No, it doesn't. So be careful of using these human aids in your Bible study. They're valuable. They have a lot of good resources. But just like checking me, you need to check what I say. You need to check what those guys say. Doesn't mean it's right. And so the Jews undertook what they had started to do, verse 23, what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the adversary of all the Jews, had schemed against the Jews to destroy them and had cast Pur, that is the lot, to disturb them and to destroy them. And when it came to the king's attention, he commanded by letter that his wicked scheme, which he had devised against the Jews, should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore, they called these days Purim. Now, I went and looked. You know, I've said, when I've been reading through here, Purim, I've said Purim. Which is the right pronunciation? I haven't found a recording yet of Mordecai. Anybody know? Anybody got a recording of Mordecai so I know how to pronounce this? But you know what? I've got a book that talks about how words are to be pronounced. And it's helpful, but I don't know if that's a... I don't know how they come to those conclusions in the first place. You know, if somebody 1,000 years from now wanted to know how we pronounce certain words, it would depend on who they listen to. If they listen to Emeril Agassi, it'd be butter. Well, we might say butter. If they listen to Paula Deen, oil would have 2 syllables. So it depends. You know, I don't know how they pronounce. It was interesting to me, I was looking at this pronunciation book, the P-U-R, the thing they cast, they said that was Pur, but then the feast would be Purim. Why, if the thing is Pur, why the feast Purim? I don't know. Don't know if any of that's correct. What I'm saying is don't worry about the pronunciation of these words when you're trying to read and study. It's not important. Okay. So this feast is established, verse 27. The Jews established and made a custom for themselves, for their descendants, and for all those who allied themselves with them, so that they would not fail to celebrate. Note, these 2 days. And now he's told why these 2 days. Okay, and so this is confirmed the latter part of chapter 9. Chapter 10 is about what? Mordecai's exaltation, right? And what I find interesting when you get to chapter 10, one of the things I find interesting here in chapter 10, I know it's very short, but it says in verse 2, "And all the accomplishments of his authority and strength and the full account of the greatness of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia?" We don't know who the author was, but obviously it was somewhere back then. By saying that this account that I've written about in the Chronicles of the kings in Persia, what does it do for this account? Gives it credibility. Go check it. Here, you can go find out if it's so. And the author wasn't afraid for anybody to do that. This is a historical account. And in their record, you can find about the exaltation of Mordecai. Now, they may not give all the details that he gave as to why that happened. But you can go read about it. And there's one other thing right quick before our time's up. Mordecai, it says in verse 3, "The Jew was second only to King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews and in favor of his with his many kinsmen." Now note this little statement. One who sought the good of his people, and one who spoke for the welfare of his whole nation. There's a principle about delegated authority that's throughout the Bible. Authority is delegated by God to rulers, to parents, to elders, whoever it may be. But it's always for what? The good of the people they rule. Rehoboam failed to recognize that. The young man said, "No, just raise their tax." The older man said, "Be a servant." What happened? Division. Rebellion. The shepherds of Israel in the book of Ezekiel are rebuked for that very thing. Jesus told the apostles in Matthew 20, if we had time to read it, he said, "You're not going to be like the Gentiles that lorded over them. You're going to be servants." So it doesn't make a difference if it's the head of my family, an elder in the church, a civil servant, whatever. The Bible teaches the principle. I need to use whatever authority I've been given for the good of the people that I serve. What a difference in Mordecai and Haman, who used his authority to gratify his selfish pride and accomplish his evil desires. Thank you for being patient as we went through the book of Esther and for your good comments and attention through the study. We're finished. The Lord willing, Rocky will begin Sunday morning in here teaching on worldliness. If you're in the annex class, Craig Ottersbach will begin teaching on the book of Psalms. Thank you very much.